This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Now for the main event, Gabe. A little bit of background on Gabe. I didn't know Gabe until he was a student here, but he grew up, he was born in Peru, then moved to Venezuela. Then moved to upstate New York for some reason because his parents wanted to go to the cold. Then he ended up, after going to Binghamton University, which is again in upstate New York, doing some computer science minor and biology major, doing an undergraduate research project. I'm sure he had important interactions with people as I did to really inspire him and show him what research was. Ended up coming out to Stanford, where he was principal violist in the Stanford Symphony. So he grew up a musician at heart, but he decided to stick it out in science. And in fact, as he told me, his impetus really to move from that lifestyle down here was because he wanted to trade the viola for a guitar and his car for a surfboard. So that worked out for a couple years, but he had to get a job. So he ended up in the lab of Jack Johnson, who is really an inspiring person. If you ever see Jack Johnson, not the musician, but the scientist, I highly encourage you because he's one of the most enthusiastic people you'll ever meet. And so Gabe fell into that lab, and once again, that's sort of by luck and by chance. And became enamored by what Jack was doing. And Jack was really working on viruses, these sort of exotic viruses that infect plants and insects and other things, bacteriophage. And he saw what imaging could do. And what imaging could do is take something, an abstract notion like a virus, something you can't see or hold in your hand, and blow it up into a screen, on a screen, and put colors on it and see all the different extensions and fibrils and surface of this virus. And really, I think that's what drove him to looking at molecular machines and assemblies. So, you know, how does a cell work? We know what a cell is, and you see those pictures of what a nucleus is in a Golgi. But within that, underneath that, are these macromolecular machines and microtubules and things that transport. And a wonderful view of cell biology that, you know, our textbooks, when I was in school, were pretty good at. But they really hadn't gone to the atomic level details and to see the actual molecules. And that's where Gabe started interfacing with all of these molecules. And like I said, becoming inspired. And so what started out as an internship turned into a graduate project. And then in order to understand better, not just the final end of making images, but how to generate those images on an electron microscope, he worked with Bridget Carragher and Clinton Potter here, who were key to developing some of the automation and took some of the legacy from Ron Milligan and moved it forward a bit. And so Gabe did his PhD here, like I said, making wonderful tools that we all use now and we all benefit from. And it's then that he went to work for Ava Nogales up at UC Berkeley. And she's, once again, an inspiring woman in her path in science, and she's very excited, and she's also, I think, South American and has a great accent, so I encourage you to look her up if you have a chance. And there, he really interacted with many different groups in this wave of electron microscopy and taking things that were blurry, blobby images and building beautiful details and intricacies into them. And taking, you know, things like Hollywood softwares and animating them and moving them and assembling them to make them really attractive and engaging and draw you in. And then about that time, I'd joined the faculty here at Scripps. And, you know, we heard that Gabe was looking for a position after his postdoc. And I remember, you know, he was down visiting for our annual microscopy course. And I remember talking to him and being really excited about bringing Gabe back here because not only is he, you know, amazing, technically skilled, and a great scientist, but he's just a great person to be around. And now, you know, his office is four offices down from me. I can go in the middle of the day, plop down on his couch, complain about things, laugh about things. And so it's a really nice fraternity that to see how you know Gabe's progression has come along, and now we're good friends and colleagues, and we're taking on the legacy built by several generations of these abstract names that people were dropping, and I didn't know who they were. And so that brings us to the main event, and that's Gabriel Lander. And I'm going to sit here and be as enamored as you guys are and inspired by his work. So without further ado, Dr. Gabriel Lander.
That's the greatest introduction I've ever received. Thank you very much, Andrew. Andrew and I were graduate students together, and Andrew is the one who taught me how to drink wine. We drank a lot of wine together. It's been a lot of fun. So, you've been staring at this title now for probably a half hour, so I'm not going to repeat the name. But I do want to say, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to come and give this talk here. It's a rarity that I get to interact and give talks to an audience like this. Usually we go to these exotic conferences where it's just a bunch of older scientists who all they want to do is nitpick your research and figure and tell you what's wrong with it, what could be done better. So it's very inspiring. It's a lot of fun to give a talk to a group of people such as yourselves. And I'm actually very, very impressed at the number of people that are here. Thinking back to when I was in high school, I don't think I would have ever signed up to spend a Saturday morning coming to a research institute and listening to a scientific talk. So I think you guys deserve the biggest round of applause here, because this is really great. So I'm going to start with this slide here. Does anyone recognize? You guys just love clapping. This is a book. A children's book that many of you, I assume, has read, The Little Prince. It's about a pilot who crash lands his plane in the Saharan desert, and he runs into this little prince person who's been traveling around from asteroid to asteroid to planets, picking up bits of information. It's a French book, and of course, because it's French, it's very philosophical and makes observations about life and human nature. But, I mean, it's a very beautiful book. And if you haven't read it, even though you're not children anymore, I encourage you to read it. And there's this beautiful line in this book. Le sentier est invisible pour les yeux. And I know there's some people here who speak French. Who speaks? It's not so different from English. I know there's two words that I know you should be able to understand. Okay, someone raise their hand and translate it. Okay, right here. Sure.
Essential is invisible for the eye.
Yes, what is essential is invisible to the eyes. Exactly, well done. And the author, when he wrote this, when he had the fox tell the little prince this line, I'm sure he meant it to mean things like love, trust, friendship. These are things that are very essential, but they're invisible. We cannot see these kinds of things. But as a biologist, I think this line is just as important and deeply profound, because it is true that everything that is essential to life is happening on a scale that is much, much smaller than what we can view by the eye. So In preparing this talk, I was trying to go back and think about what it was like when I was in high school and what I would want to hear from a presentation as a high schooler from a scientist. So I had to take myself back 20 years. And I don't have Facebook, but if I had a Facebook page, it would look something like this. There's my profile pic. Andrew Ward, who also doesn't have Facebook in this imaginary world, is my Facebook friend. And I have all my other friends. I was really nervous about the talk, so my friends are sending me, words of encouragement. But so Facebook has this really cool tool at the far right underneath the advertisements to buy electron microscopes. And it's called the timeline. And Facebook came around in 2004, and people didn't really start using it until a few years after that. So the timeline doesn't go back that far. But if you went to my imaginary Facebook timeline and went back to when I was in high school, you'd be going back to the early to mid-90s. This was a very different time. This was a guy. He was in the White House. He was in charge running things. If you don't know, this is Bill Clinton, looking much younger than what you see nowadays. And there's a chance that he might be back in the White House. It seems like his wife is running for president. So we'll see how that works out. So computers and the internet. This is what it looked like back in the mid-90s. So big, bulky machines. They weren't very good. All the cell phones in your pockets now are way more powerful than these computers that we were using back then. And this is what the internet looked like. Everything was Times New Roman, or maybe just Times Roman. And I remember the first time my dad is a computer scientist, and he took me to his computer lab and said, "This is the internet." And I said, "This is awful. This will never catch on. Who would ever use this?" But obviously it's exploded, and the internet is a critical aspect of our lives now. And if you wanted to check your email or do email, you had to use oftentimes a Pine software that looked like this. It was very tedious, and I didn't even have an email account in high school. I didn't get my first email account until college, and it was bg18954@binghamton.edu. So we weren't on the internet, we weren't on computers all the time because they were pretty awful as far as browsing the web, so we had to entertain ourselves with other things. And these were the fads going around when I was in high school. Pog, I never understood Pogs. There's these chips that you hit with something else and they bounce around. I don't get it. Magic the Gathering was a card game that came out in 1993, and all the nerds all played. Does this still around? Do people play Magic? Go nerds! And then the first-person shooters also came out at this time. This is Wolfenstein 3D. I spent a lot of time playing this game. And music. I was really into music in high school, and grunge was like the thing back in the mid-90s. Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. If you had you had Discmen back then, you had to put a CD in and then put your earphones onto that. And I would spend a lot of time listening to this music. And if I had Facebook back in 1994, I'd have to have a profile pic, and this would have been my profile pic. So. Not a budding young scientist here. I was really not into science, and I think this seems to be a common theme in all these talks. Ryan Shenvey said he wasn't that terribly into science in high school. He was more into art and music, and I was in the same boat. I really enjoyed spending time in the art rooms, playing in the orchestra. I had a couple bands that I played in. The science was not a big part of my life in this area, or during this time. But then I went to college, and in college I signed up for all the art classes and the theater classes, and I played in the orchestra there. And then I realized that I really enjoyed the biology classes a lot more than I was enjoying the art classes. For some reason, there was something about the biology and learning useful things about what's happening inside our bodies that really turned me on to biology. Specifically, it was structural biology. I started working in a research lab of Susan Bain, who works on microtubules at Binghamton University. And there I started learning about structural biology. And the cell has tons of structures inside them. You've got, you know, these big organizations of organelles and nucleus. And inside the nucleus, you've got all your genetic material. Then around that, you've got rough endoplasmic reticulums. The Golgi apparatus, which is the funnest name to say of all the organelles. Mitochondria, microtubules, all these things. So this is the representation of the cell that we were all introduced to when you think about the cell. So do you think this is an accurate representation of the cell? Who thinks this is a pretty decent, accurate representation of the cell? That's it? Only two people? I mean, it's got all the pieces, right? Really? There's two people? Come on, more people than that think this is an accurate representation of the cell. Yeah, you're wrong. Wrong. I'm sorry. I won't do that again. But you're wrong. The cell is this massive, you know, organization that's just churning with carbohydrates, nucleic acids, proteins, and they're all interacting with one another. Ooh. And something you'll notice is the cellular interior is just chock full of molecules, and they're all interacting with one another. And even, I mean, there's not even space for that many water molecules. Every single water molecule inside the cell has to be accounted for in some way. And these proteins obviously are not just single static complexes. They're all, you know, turning and moving around and interacting with each other. Up here you've got antibodies that are blocking a viral infection. These are ion transporters that are, you know, keeping ions levels from the interior exterior separate from one another. Over here we've got the ATP synthase, which is the motor that generates all the energy modules inside the cell. This is transport of proteins from the cytoplasm to the interior of mitochondria. This is an overview of viral infection. And over here, this is a movie that tries to just show you how crowded the interior of the cell is. So the cell is not this textbook view of, you know, you've got all your different compartments in specific places. And in fact, it's just churning mass. But despite that, when we look at biology and try to explain biology in textbooks, oftentimes you look at diagrams like this, where each protein or each molecule is, you know, distinguished or specified by some kind of circle or an oval or a hexagon, and you look at these pathways and they're very complicated. But as structural biologists, we're just not satisfied with this circle A, you know, activates this other circle, and this one over here inhibits this ability of this circle here to interact with this circle. These circles are not circles inside the cell. They are actually, you know, three-dimensional structures. And this is what I really like about structural biology, is that it's a tangible field that you can look at the structures of these different complexes, and the structure defines its function. So the 3D shape of these structures, of these proteins, dictate precisely how these proteins interact with each other or with other chemicals inside the cell. And if we know how every single atom is organized inside this protein structure, this gives us incredible power over our ability to manipulate that function of that cell. We can design chemicals that either enhance its ability to carry out a specific task, or if it's a problematic protein, we can find ways to inhibit it from performing destructive things inside the cell. And as I mentioned, these proteins don't just interact with small molecules or chemicals inside the cell, but they also interact with other proteins and with one another. And again, the three-dimensional organization of these proteins dictate its ability to interact with other proteins. And it's very oftentimes that one protein interacting with another protein will turn it on or turn it off. So let's say for this case, this is an active form of some very dangerous bacterial protein that will start just wreaking havoc inside the cell. When it's assembled like this, it's in on state. But it's very likely that there exists in nature, or that we can design proteins just based on the knowledge of our 3D structure, the 3D organization of this protein, that there's another protein that come in and prohibit that other dangerous interaction. So now this is this dangerous protein in the off state. And this is how antibodies work generally. The antibodies can recognize a certain feature on a protein based on its three-dimensional shape and block it. And Andrew's lab is very interested in doing HIV research and finding out the structures of antibodies and using these antibodies to block HIV infection, coming up with vaccines to combat HIV. So I hope in these few slides I've impressed upon you the importance of three-dimensional structure, and that our ability to manipulate these proteins depends on our knowledge of the 3D structure. So the question now, how do we determine the 3D shape of a protein? Is this something that we can see? No, these are invisible to the eye. So let's just look at the sense, I want to give you a sense of the scale of going from the eye down to how small these proteins are. So what is the smallest thing that we can see with an eye? Does anyone know? What scale we can see? The smallest thing you can imagine. Silence. No idea. You can see a hair, right? You can see the thickness of a hair. Right? That's about a tenth of a millimeter. But we don't have a lot of resolution in this range. If you took two hairs and you twisted them around each other and tried to, you know, see if are those two different hairs or is this just one single hair, our eyes are not finely tuned enough to be able to distinguish that level of detail. So if we can see a human hair, can we see bacteria? Generally, you cannot, but there is one bacteria that is so big that we can actually see it by the human eye. It's Thiomargarita, it's a really fun-sounding virus, Margarita namibiensis. But it's, you know, it's despite being the largest bacteria, it is still pretty small. To give you a sense of how small this bacteria is, this is a raspberry, and this is a fruit fly. You've all seen fruit flies, right? They're these tiny little bugs. If you leave bananas out for too long, you start getting fruit flies flying around them. So the fruit fly, the scientific name is Drosophila melanogaster, and if this is the size of what that bacteria is relative to a fruit fly. So this is, you know, a tiny, tiny, tiny speck. And this is about 100 times bigger than most other bacteria. E. coli is 100 times smaller than this speck. So E. coli is not something that we would ever be able to see with our eyes. And people have been, you know, trying to figure out how to make small things like this more visible for thousands of years. The Greeks used to fill up glass balls or spheres with water and use those as kind of makeshift magnifying glasses to make small things look bigger. And one of the great reasons that we want to be able to make small things larger is to be able to treat people. And the development of medicine relies very heavily on being able to see how small things work. So let's say a patient comes in who's been experiencing some kind of memory loss. Doctors are very good at using their eyes. Scientists are also very good at using their eyes to diagnose issues. But there's a very, you know, it's a limit to what you can see. If you have someone who's losing their memory, there's probably something going on inside the brain that's going wrong, and then we have to figure out what that is. So you could use a magnifying lamp, perhaps, and that would give you a 10x view, and you could look at the skin on the surface of the head. But obviously, this is not going to tell you what's going on inside. So next up, we could use a traditional light microscope, and this is going to then allow you to see the ultrastructure of the tissue inside the cells. You can take a biopsy and just do some staining and look at it at this level of detail, and we can see the cellular organization. And sometimes this is enough to tell you what's going wrong inside the cells here. But if not, you have to go even smaller. And this is the most powerful light microscope probably you can get. It's an oil immersion light microscope, and this gives you 1,000x magnification. So now we can start seeing cells, individual cells. And this is one of those cells. Does anyone recognize what kind of cell this is? It's a neuron, yes. It's a very, very, it has a very specific shape and very easily identifiable. But this is about the maximum resolution that we can get using light microscopy. But again, we want to know what's going on inside of these cells to really be able to treat these patients. So in order to view the structures that I was talking about, these protein structures, we need to do another thousandfold increase in magnification. So everything that took us from our eyes looking at the cells, we have to repeat that one more time. So we need to get a much, much better, higher resolution view of what's going on inside the cell. And for this, light is limited. And I hope this I'm going to try to explain this as best I can. But light has a particular wavelength. It is visible light, occupies a certain small region of the electromagnetic spectrum. Has everyone heard about the electromagnetic spectrum? I see some nodding of the heads. You don't have to know what it means. But generally, light it's in the range of 400 to 700 nanometers. And 600 nanometers is a very, very long wavelength. It's too big to look at something that's 100 times smaller than that. So to give you a sense of the scale of what we're trying to see with these large wavelengths, I'm going to put this down that small. Can you see that spot? So it's trying to use something that's 600 nanometers big to look at something that's very, very, very tiny. It's like going to Leonardo da Vinci and say, Leonardo, I want you to paint me a Mona Lisa. And he says, okay, that is good, yes. And then you say, but I want you to use a paintbrush that's the size of this stage. And that's all you can use. And he'll say, you're crazy, go away. It's not the right tool to use to look at something so small. So this is why we turn to electrons. Electrons have a wavelength that are 100,000 times shorter than the wavelength of light. So now we can go back to Leonardo da Vinci and say, okay, now I'm giving you the finest, tiniest brushes. You can make the most detailed painting ever in the world. He probably wouldn't talk to you because he thinks you're a crazy person, but it's what we use. And these are what electron microscopes look like. They've started out looking very clunky and small, and like these lens of these columns, and now they look more like very fancy refrigerators. But if you open up these boxes, you still have a series of lenses that look like this. And this is our electron microscopy suite here at Scripps, actually right across the way on the other side of the building. And a very lucky few of you will get to go and walk through the electron microscopy suite, load some samples into an electron microscope, not the super fancy ones, but one of the microscopes there. And to give you a sense of scale of what how big these microscopes are, this is how tall, you know, an average person would be standing next to our biggest microscope, the Titan Krios that you can see right there. So how do these work? A light microscope. Who's used a light microscope here? Yes, hopefully everyone has used a light microscope. Very enthusiastic hand raiser there. So how do they work? You have a light source at the bottom, and then it goes through a series of lenses. The light gets refracted, focused on a specimen, which sits right there, and then it gets magnified, and you can look in through these eyepieces and see a magnified version of this specimen using light. And these lenses are lenses as what you would normally think about. What are in your eyeglasses, this is a glass lens here, and the light microscope uses a series of these glass lenses. An electron microscope is not terribly different. Instead of using these glass lenses, we use electromagnetic lenses. So instead of having light, we have an electron source, which shoots electrons down the interior of the column here. The column is actually a vacuum so that the electrons can pass through. But the electrons go through the same kind of series of lenses. They condense, they hit the specimen, then they get magnified, and you look at it, but not at the top. What we do in electron microscopy is we flip the whole thing upside down. So the electrons come out from the top, and then we look at the sample down underneath. So great, now we can start looking at very, very, very tiny things. But we have problems. Biological samples, us, we are about 80% water. We're just bags of water that walk around. And if you place biological samples into a vacuum, what happens? You have no pressure, and there's nothing keeping the water in liquid form, and it starts evaporating, bubbling, and eventually you just dehydrate your sample. You will destroy your sample if you go into a vacuum. So that's bad. We don't want to destroy our samples. And then we have another probably bigger problem, and this is that biological samples are very susceptible to radiation damage. Electrons, when they're coming down this beam at 200 kiloelectron volts or 300 kiloelectron volts, they are very, very damaging. This is an incredible amount of radiation. So here's a quick conversion, back of the envelope. From electron flux to radiation dose. 1 coulomb per meter squared at 100 keV is about 40 megarads. And if you want to use this level of, if we want to be able to view things in the electron microscope, we typically use 30 coulombs per meter squared per second, which is 1,200 megarads per second. Wow. Does that mean anything? Is that a lot?
Yes.
Is that a little? How much is it?
A lot.
A lot. How much? It's good that you know that it's a lot, but does it really mean anything? 1,200 megarads per second? I don't know what 1,200 megarads per second. I'll put it in terms that we can all understand. 1,200 megarads per second is about the same as standing 30 meters from the center of a 10 megaton H-bomb explosion. You would be vaporized instantly if you're hit with that much megarad. Just a lot of radiation. So what do? We are putting our samples into a vacuum, and then we're dropping H-bombs on them. So we need to protect them in some way from this. So what can we do? How do we preserve our samples? Any ideas? What could we do? Why? I mean, obviously it works. We found some solution to this problem. Any ideas? Okay, I'll show you. Here we go. Does anyone know what I have under here?
A microscope.
Wrong again. I have bananas. We use bananas to do this. No, we use liquid nitrogen. So liquid nitrogen is very, very cold. It's nitrogen, which is the most abundant gas in the air, and it's been turned into a liquid. So it's minus 195 degrees centigrade, minus 319 degrees Fahrenheit. This is very, very cold liquid. And what we're going to do... Oh, I can't do anything until I put on my safety gear. Because we're scientists. Really? The people in my lab are laughing because they never see me put any of this stuff on. Okay, so we've got my safety glasses. You all have a pair, right, as well? And I'm going to put on these safety gloves. And what we're going to do is freeze a banana in liquid nitrogen to show you how hard it gets. So we're going to fill this guy up. And this is going to take a little while to equilibrate because this is obviously room temperature, which is 25 degrees centigrade, and we have to go down to minus 195. So it's going to bubble and steam for a little while. Okay, so I've got a banana. Okay, banana. Into the liquid nitrogen. So 25 degrees Celsius, minus 195 degrees Celsius. Okay. So what we're going to do is it's going to freeze. And what's happening now is the molecules in the banana are slowing down and slowing down and slowing down to the getting to the point where the molecules can barely even move. Every single molecule just becomes part of this massive substrate of frozen molecules, which is very resistant now to radiation damage. So it's also very, very, very hard. So we're going to do an experiment. We're going to try to use this banana to hammer a nail through a piece of wood. There's my piece of scrap wood. It's pine. It's a kind of soft wood, but it's still pretty hard. I mean, it's a piece of wood. I'm trying to get the nail I have in my pocket out. So it's still bubbling, which means it's still equilibrating and trying to get to minus 195 degrees Fahrenheit, or Celsius. Okay, so it's pretty cold now. I'm going to take the banana out. Whoa.
Oh my gosh.
So, I don't think this is going to work. I was going to take a pole, but clearly that didn't work. So here's our nail. And we're going to use our very, very hard banana. The molecules are barely moving. And try to hammer this nail into the board. One, two, three. No. The bananas are very, very hard. But they're very, very brittle. So there's a difference between hard and brittle. So what's happened is the molecules are so cold that they are unable to move. They can't flex. I need to pick these up because they're going to eventually thaw. And, oh man, that's cold. And then we're going to have banana all over the floor. So they can't move. So they become very brittle. It's like, so a diamond is very, very hard, but it's also very brittle. You can crack a diamond relatively easily. And that's what's happened now with the banana. It's very, very brittle. You can break it if you apply physical force. But it's cold to the point that the molecules can't move. And so it's very, very resistant to a hydrogen bomb blast. So if you put this next to the hydrogen bomb blast, it would last for a little while. I mean, eventually it would get irradiated, but it would definitely last much longer than if we just had a regular banana in the electron microscope. So that's the end of the demo. Should I freeze anything else?
Yeah.
We'll freeze more stuff later. How about that? So that's how we prepare samples for cryo-EM. We drop them into liquid nitrogen. I'm dropping bananas everywhere. I'm never going to get to do this ever again. A guy came and he threw bananas all over the place. Okay, so here's our sample that has our bananas in it. No, we don't look at bananas. This is our purified protein sample. And inside of this sample prep, we've got our protein of interest that we want to solve the structure for floating around in solution, and you can see they're tumbling and moving around. But of course, we want to freeze it. We want to lock every single molecule in one single layer of very, very thin ice. And this ice has to be frozen so fast that the water molecules don't have a chance to rearrange and form cubic ice. This ice has to be glass-like. Every single water molecule has to be in exact same orientation and position that it was when it was in the liquid form. So how do we do this? We put them onto this small, very small millimeter, 3 millimeter grid. This is a copper grid. And if you look very closely at the grid under a light microscope, you can see that it has this cross grating. These are very small squares. And then on top of those squares, we overlay a very thin layer of nanofabricated carbon. These carbon, as you can see, have very small little holes punched into them. And our sample eventually, that very, very thin layer of ice and holding our sample is going to occupy those very small holes. So what we do is we add a small little amount of our sample to the surface of this grid. But this is a very, very thick layer of sample. Obviously, we want to make it from 3 microliters, sorry, not from 3 microliters, but, you know, several millimeters in thickness to, you know, a few nanometers. So this drop is 100,000 times too thick. So how do we make this from a very thick drop to a very, very thin layer of ice? We have a very, very sophisticated way of doing this. What we do is we take this and we take a piece of paper and we smack the paper against the drop and then pull it away after a little while and then plunge it into liquid ethane. And magically that works. So here, I'll show you a video of one of my postdocs, Saket Chaudhary, freezing a grid in using this technique. So this is our sample hanging on a little drop, and then this is the piece of paper that he's going to hold against it. And this is a Dewar that's holding liquid nitrogen, but in the center of the liquid nitrogen, we have a little tube that's holding liquid ethane. So why do we use ethane over liquid nitrogen? It has a much higher specific heat. Is that a term that anyone here knows? Specific heat, I think I learned about it in elementary school. Surely you've heard of specific heat. It's the ability to transfer heat from one object to the next. So if I put my hand into liquid nitrogen, the liquid nitrogen will evaporate and will form a cloud of nitrogen vapor around my hand. My hand won't get damaged. If I drop my hand into a Dewar full of liquid ethane, the liquid ethane has a very high specific heat. It's going to immediately suck all the heat out of my hand and turn my hand into, you know, a frozen banana that I could, you know, smack on the podium and break into a million pieces. So liquid ethane will freeze this sample very, very quickly. But because it's so dangerous, we only use a small amount of it, and it's sitting in a Dewar full of liquid nitrogen to keep it cold. So this is the process involved in getting a very thick layer of sample into a very, very thin, you know, a few nanometers thin layer of ice. Ready? He's going to press it against the sample. You see it wicking away, and then it plunges down into liquid ethane. It's crazy that this works. It's just really mind-boggling. This is the way people have been doing it for 70 years. There are new machines that you can buy that will do this. These cost tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars, but essentially they're doing exactly the same thing. You have your sample sitting inside this little chamber, and on either side you have pieces of paper, and the pieces of paper just close down on that sample, and then the sample drops down into liquid ethane. And that's how we go from molecules floating around in our sample in solution into this very thin layer of ice. So then we take this and we put this into our electron microscope. And what we do is then hit it with an electron beam. And it's frozen, so the electron beam doesn't completely vaporize all the samples immediately, but it does leave this little imprint on a detector that we have underneath. And this is important because what it's doing is it's taking all the three-dimensional information from each of these, each particle, each molecule, and saving all that three-dimensional information in this two-dimensional space down underneath. And to give you a sense of what that looks like, this is a projection. We've got the molecule in different orientations, and depending on the orientation, we get a unique, I don't want to call it a shadow because it's not really a true shadow. If I was standing here and someone stood right in front of me, then my shadow would not get any darker. because all you're having to do is put one thing in front of the light, and it'll block any light from coming. But the way electron microscope works is if you have something stacked up, we have more density stacked up, it leads to darker shadows down underneath. So it's how three-dimensional information is captured onto a two-dimensional plane. But we want to get back to three dimensions. So how do we do this? This is what a typical micrograph looks like. We've got our sample embedded in the ice, and this is an image of it. But somehow, we're going from very, very, very noisy images. The reason we can't, these images are so noisy is because it's still a lot of radiation we're putting on. So we just put a tiny bit of radiation. We drop many, many H-bombs on all these samples to just barely recover some information about them. But somehow we're going from this to atomic resolution and figuring out where individual molecules are. So how does this happen? And the power is in averaging. So if we take this micrograph and we crop out all the particles that look like they're in the similar orientation and then extract them from the image. So now the contrast is inverted to confuse you. These are all the particles that we've pulled out and they're in different orientations and we can figure out how they all line up relative to each other. So now they're all in the same orientation and then we can average them together to get a much higher resolution representation of that one particular view. And then we can do this for all the different views, combine them because all these views contain three-dimensional information and get back a three-dimensional structure. And using this electron density, we can then start modeling in our protein complex and figuring out what it looks like and what the structure is. So that's how electron microscopy works. So what do I use electron microscopy for? We are very interested in neurodegenerative diseases. So I know Sandra Encalada, who gave the first Science Saturday in September. But just to recapitulate, neurodegenerative diseases, these are essentially diseases that kill the brain from the inside out. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. You all remember the bucket challenge. That was combating this neurodegenerative disease. Huntington's. These are all diseases that affect loss of motor control, as you can see in this video. It also affects memory and cognitive function. Eventually, people who have these neurodegenerative diseases, their brain stops being able to control and keep their body in a functional state, and they die from their organs shutting down and not being able to breathe. I mean, it's really awful. And it's an age-related disease because our chances of getting these diseases increase with age. 10% of all people over 65 in the U.S. have some form of neurodegenerative disease. We spend $1.3 trillion per year on healthcare costs for these people who have neurodegenerative diseases. So it's a lot of people. It's 6 million people in the U.S. alone. You can imagine how that goes across the entire world. And the problem is the causes of these are very, very poorly understood. This is not a viral infection. It's not a bacterial infection that triggers these diseases. So there's not some foreign agent that we can target, find the structure of, and then combat it using traditional techniques. And unlike cancer or other chronic diseases like heart disease, where there are therapeutics that work and oftentimes people can get cured, there are no cures for neurodegenerative diseases. There are only treatments that will alleviate the symptoms, but in no case do your neurons that are dying or being killed by these neurodegenerative diseases start regrowing. So again, there's no cure. So it's very scary, and this is something that we're very interested in finding out why these neurodegenerative diseases, it's a hard word to say over and over again, neurodegenerative diseases. We can't combat them because we don't know why they start, how they start, and we don't really understand how neurons work. So when they start killing neurons, we don't really know what's happening either. So this is I'm going to go through an animation from Drew Barry. He's a fantastic biologist and medical artist. He's a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. And this is a mouse. We use mice a lot for neurodegenerative diseases studies because their brains, honestly, are not so different from ours when we get down to the molecular level. Inside this mouse, you've got a skull. Inside the skull is this magnificent, beautiful organ. It's the most amazing organ that exists on the planet, especially ours. Ours is much cooler than the mouse ones. But again, on the molecular level, they're not so different. The brain, it controls an astonishing number of, you know, of things. Everything that you're doing, you're breathing, you're looking, you're listening to my voice, you're sitting down, but also in the back of your head, you're thinking about what you're going to do afterwards. You're going to think about what you're going to eat later on today. If you're stressed out about a test you've got coming up, all this is happening in your brain at the same time. You're digesting your food, and your brain is controlling all these things at the same time. You don't even think about it. Even the mouse's brain, which is the size of a pea, it's a very, very small brain. It's more powerful than the most powerful supercomputing cluster that we have on the planet. So it's really, really impressive. And the reason that it's so impressive is it's very, very complex. So the brain has many different pieces, and this is one sliver of the hippocampus, the dentate gyrus, which is responsible for generating memories. And if we zoom in on just this tiny sliver of this pea-sized brain, you can see that it's loaded with billions and billions and billions of these small cells. And these cells are neurons. And Sandra, when in her talk, described the organization of these neurons. You've got dendrites, you've got the cell body, and then you've got this axon. And with light microscopy, you can get to the point where you can go to this axon and see what's going on inside this axon at an impressive level of resolution. We can see things moving up and down inside the cell. Does anyone know what these objects are that are moving up and down the cell? One person. Yes, you. Action potentials. No, those. So action potentials, there are lots of those. Yes, there are tons of those going up, but they are not large enough to be able to see by light microscopy. So these are. Keep in mind, light microscopy is not that great at seeing very, very tiny things on this scale. So these are pretty large structures that are moving up and down. These are organelles, vesicles, things that are membranes that are carrying signaling molecules, repair molecules, nutrients. It's the highway of the axon. And if you don't have proper functioning of this cargo movement transport, then your neurons will start dying. It's very similar to the highway system we have in the U.S. If you in any way disrupt the highway system, you have a hurricane that wipes out a section of this freeway, you're going to lose your ability to move from point A to point B. So this transport system is very, very important for the interior of the cells. So two things we need for movement. We need stable, clean roadways, and we need vehicles like our cars to carry the cargo. So inside the neurons, the highways, the roadways, are microtubules. These are 25 nanometer diameter tubes that run the length, hundreds and hundreds of them, inside the axons of healthy neurons. And the building block for these microtubules is the tubulin heterodimer. And these proteins stack up head to tail to form protofilaments, and these protofilaments then undergo lateral interactions to form sheets, and these sheets then wrap around and form a closed tubular cylindrical microtubule. And then, so that's the roadway, and then we've got the vehicles, the motors. And Sandra also introduced these motors, something that we are both very interested in working on and studying. The kinesins, they move in one direction, and the dynines move in another direction. So unlike our car, which can go forward and reverse, these motors are built to only go in one direction ever. Kinesins are very, very well studied. They've been characterized for many decades, and our understanding of kinesins comes about in large part due to the electron microscopy done by Ron Milligan, who's a professor here at Scripps. And from his work, people have been able to construct movies like this. I'm sure you've seen this movie before, where the kinesins walking along this microtubule highway with this hand-over-hand motion. It's a cartoon, but it is grounded in the structural information that we've been able to discern in a large part from electron microscopy. So what happens if you lose the microtubule or you disrupt the motion of the vehicles here? So this is an excerpt from a YouTube video I found online that does a great job of showing what's happening here in these cases. So this is one microtubule running through the center of the axon. As I said before, there are typically hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these microtubules running along the interior of the neuronal cell. But you want these to be very stable, as I said before. And the cell has lots of proteins that can decorate. You can see these worm-like structures decorating the surface of the microtubule, and that keeps it very stable, and it keeps it from falling apart. In certain neurodegenerative diseases, these worm-like structures, called the tau protein, loses its ability to stabilize the microtubule. And when this happens, the microtubule will, it's a term called catastrophe. It just depolymerizes, it falls apart. These tau proteins, these mutant tau proteins, can then go on to form aggregates and clump up inside the cell, preventing any further transport or growth of new microtubules inside the cell. And the neuron eventually just dies. So what can we do with the electron microscopy to get at this question? So again, this is a light microscope looking at movement of this cargo. With an electron microscope, we have the resolution where we can go in and look at a single microtubule inside neurons and see, you see, this is a microtubule, obviously, and the contrast is, again, is inverted. It's a light microtubule on a dark background, and you see these kind of worm-like structures. These are not the tau proteins. The tau proteins are very, very small, but these are the motors, and this is the first time that we were able to, or probably, I think any group has been able to purify motors, native motors, out of mouse brains and look at them in the electron microscope. And using our averaging technologies, we were able to build up a much better understanding of the organization of this motors. So unlike kinesin, this is the dynein motor. We know very, very little about the dynein motor. It doesn't move using that hand-over-hand motion that the kinesin molecule does. It's been studied for decades, and we still know very, very little about it. And just in the past year, we've been able to learn a lot more about it and really further our understanding of the dynein motor. The dynein motor is just this yellow portion. It also interacts with a larger cofactor. And we can extrapolate from these very nice images to three-dimensional models of what the dynein motor looks like. So this is the actual motor portion that uses energy to convert chemical energy into three-dimensional structural reorganizations that will allow the motor to move in one direction. But then it has this big tail that then interacts with this large adapter complex. And this adapter complex is critical in the dynein motor's ability to move. So what we want to do in future studies, figure out how do these motors work? How do the motors transfer chemical energy to rearrangements that affect the interactions at the microtubule surface? And then how and why does this motor interact with the adapter, and how does the adapter affect its ability to move? And then on top of that, how does all this interact with larger cargo at the top, such as mitochondria, and move them? So what I would love to show next is a movie showing how this thing just walks along. But the problem is we don't know. And I'm not even going to make a guess at what is happening here. And this is where the field is at right now. So unlike when you read a textbook and you're in science class, you're like, oh, they've got it all figured out. I'm learning all this stuff. But there's so much that we don't know. And that's one of the great things about coming to lab is that if you discover something, this planet has I don't know how many billions of people on it, and you're the only person in the whole world that is able to see this thing for the very first time, and it's very, very exciting, and it's what motivates us to slave away in lab for so many years. So what we want to do in the future then is compare the structures of the microtubules, of the motors, of the interactions with the cargo that are being transported, look at them in healthy neurons, and then compare the same structures, look at the same identical molecules, and see what they look like in diseased neurons. How are the interactions with the microtubule being affected or influenced that are causing it to the stabilizing molecules to dissociate? How are the motors being affected by this? And hopefully, through this research, start building up an understanding of why neurodegenerative diseases come about in the first place, figure out how to diagnose them earlier, and then most importantly, how to come up with cures to fight them. So I hope over the course of this lecture, I've really emphasized and imposed on you the interesting kind of research that we can do using electron microscopy to look at the fundamental features and structures that govern life itself. So before I wrap up, I just want to thank, of course, organizers for the Science Saturdays. This is the third one that we've had. I think they've been wildly successful. I'm really glad and happy to be a part of it. Shirley King, Rachel Meisner. I need to thank the Scripps Graduate Program. And again, the movies that I've shown you are a result of the work that are being that's being done in my lab by very talented postdocs and graduate students. That's the funding to fund the research that I was doing. And I also want to thank the sponsor here as well. And thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.